Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Dr. Doris Santoro. Dr. Santoro is a professor and philosopher of education at Bowdoin College, whose work focuses on the moral and ethical sources of teacher dissatisfaction and resistance. She's also the author of a book entitled Demoralized: Why Teachers Leave the Profession They Love and How They Can Stay. Dr. Santoro, thank you for being on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Chris.
So I want to start by asking you, what motivated you to study why teachers decide to leave the profession of teaching?
Well, my advisor in my doctoral program was David Hansen, who wrote The Call to Teach. And it's only recently that I've realized and recalled that I had this conversation with him where he talks at length and demonstrates very persuasively that for many teachers, there are moral reasons why they enter the profession. And I recall asking him at the time, you know, so if there are moral reasons for why teachers enter the profession, couldn't there also be moral reasons for why teachers leave the profession? And in excellent advisor mode, he said, excellent question. Perhaps that's something that you should pursue one day. And so, you know, I set that question aside for a little while, and I did still focus on the ethics of teaching. But it was really when I received an email from a former colleague at a high school where I taught. And this woman was an incredible teacher. I'd taught, you know, side by side with her. And, you know, she was one of those people who looked at her students, her ninth grade students, and would say, I can't wait to tell your kids when they're my student what you were doing when you were a ninth grader. Right? She was someone who intended to be a lifer. And, you know, all of the literature that I was reading at the time was about, you know, that teaching was this, you know, profession that people went in for the short term. And if they left, you know, often it was because it wasn't a good fit for them, or they no longer were drawn to the work. And, you know, what I received was this email from this woman, Lisa, telling me about her decision to resign. And one of the things she wrote in that letter, it was a letter to her colleagues at the staff at the school that she shared with me, was that she said, you know, I just don't feel like I'm teaching the way I want to anymore. And while there's one way to read that, which is, you know, I wanted to use like glitter and teach, you know, the Catcher in the Rye, that's not what she was saying. What she was saying was that she couldn't teach the way she thought she should be teaching. And that wasn't because she as a person, as a practitioner, no longer had the capacity or the juice to do that. But it's that the conditions in which she was now working no longer enabled her to do the good work that she was previously able to do. And so I was very interested in that. And so what I sought out to do was to understand experienced teachers' motivations for leaving the profession. So these are people who had overcome that five-year hurdle where we know that about 50% of teachers leave. These are people who have already demonstrated they have a commitment to the profession. We would imagine that they have some facility for teaching if they've been doing it for that long, because quite frankly, I think teaching is far too difficult of a job to be doing it poorly and to be in it for that long, although of course there are people who do. But I wanted to know why people who loved teaching, who intended to stay in teaching, and who still were very motivated to teach left the profession. So that's what encouraged, you know, that sort of set me forth on this path. And, you know, what I'm doing now is actually focusing, and this happened, I had set this project up a couple of years ago, and it's really taking shape now, but I'm now studying specifically the moral and ethical reasons that teachers of color and educators of color are leaving the profession. Because what we know is that while we see all of this work devoted to recruiting more teachers of color, we also know that they have the highest rates of turnover of anyone. And again, I have a hard time believing that that's because there's something inherently wrong with educators of color. Instead, I think that we need to look at the conditions that they are encountering in this work and better understand, particularly in the moral and ethical components of it, what might be driving them away into other professions.
So to that point, you make a distinction between demoralization and burnout. How would you distinguish between those two?
Burnout really centers on the individual. You know, it's the idea that the individual's got no more gas, no more juice to offer in the profession, that they've run out of steam. You know, I really like to think of the image, you know, to make this metaphor literal and to think of the image of a candle. And if a candle burns down or burns out, there's no coming back from that. You know, you can't reconstitute a candle. And all of this is suggesting that somehow, you know, we are apportioned limited resources as teachers, and we better do our best to conserve them, right? So instead of, you know, being frivolous and potentially burning your, you know, 30-hour candle that you got, you know, all night long, and then regretting that, you know, that expensive candle you bought is no longer, you know, is basically gone. Like, we're supposed to be taking better care of ourselves. Well, I actually don't think teachers or teaching is like that. I actually think that there are renewable resources in teaching. And so one of the challenges is when we can't access those renewable resources. And the renewable resources are what a philosopher would call the moral goods of the profession. What makes teaching desirable? What makes you feel as though you're doing good work that is valuable and doing it in a responsible way? And so demoralization is not about a problem with the individual. It's a problem with the conditions that the individual faces in their work. And so they, you know, are potentially motivated by this good. Maybe the good is being able to reach young people and help identify their passions and draw them out. Well, if you're now teaching, you know, in some sort of highly regimented manner, where all students are expected to demonstrate the same competencies and there isn't any room for that kind of individualization, then a teacher's not going to be able to realize those moral goods that drew them to the profession. So demoralization is about those conditions and not being able to do, you know, either what you think is good, right, or just as someone in this role.
So why would you say it's important to make that distinction between burnout and demoralization?
Well, I think that and some of this, I have to say, I believed was important when I wrote the book, but has become even more clear to me since I wrote the book. And I've talked to teachers why this is so important. So first of all, if we think that burnout is the problem, then we're going to focus on ensuring that teachers, again, use those resources wisely, you know, practice self-care and, you know, set good boundaries. And again, these are excellent things to do. They're very important. I'm not denigrating that. But, you know, if the problem is the conditions of the work, meaning it's this curriculum or it is the sort of disciplinary policies that you believe are targeting students of color in ways that are damaging and you feel complicit in that. And you came to be a teacher who, you know, empowered your community, then you're going to have a problem with that. But that problem isn't you. The problem is those conditions around you. And so we end up with a misdiagnosis and we don't know where to actually put the remedy. You know, so teachers who are really dedicated to their work and who are feeling incredible amounts of frustration and anxiety and depression, those might be signs of burnout, but they might be signs of demoralization. And distinguishing the source is really important. And then also letting teachers know that the problem is not intrinsic to them, but is an environmental concern, really shifts where the burden lies. And it doesn't mean that teachers don't have any work to do in those situations, but it does mean shifting the focus of burnout, where the problem in burnout is the problem is you, teacher. You couldn't hack it.
So what policies have you found lead to demoralization?
You know, some that are really easy to point to are strict curriculum pacing. So if your goal is to be able to ensure that students understand and that you're drawing on their interests, if you need to march through some curriculum regardless, and you're watching students either struggle or not being able to, you know, utilize certain toeholds that might be engaging to them, that can be demoralizing. Scripted curriculum, where you're told every single thing to say, and you are no longer a person, but you are an automaton who just happens to take flesh, the form of flesh, that is demoralizing. If your goal was to be a person among people, definitely over testing and test prep. And the exorbitant amount of time devoted to that is demoralizing if that doesn't align with what you envision a rich, full, and challenging education can be. In particular, there are also issues of equity within that, thinking about students with disabilities or English language learners who, as a result of the requirement that they sit through these tests, you know, ended up feeling terrible about themselves or subjected them to situations that were really cruel. One teacher told me about a student with physical disabilities who they were proctoring for an exam. And, you know, it had all of these, which in many ways is a sign of a good test, right? There were things that you had to manipulate and ways you needed to kind of do some authentic tasks on the screen. But for the student with physical disabilities, this was excruciating, and it was certainly not testing what the student could know. Instead, it tested their, you know, willingness to put up with something that was really, really, really challenging. And so the teacher felt horribly complicit in that. I think there are also examples of schools and districts investing in products rather than people, whether that product is highly paid consultants who would, you know, tout something and then disappear, where the teachers themselves were feeling either underpaid or underrecognized when they had experience, expertise, and wanted to participate, but you know, it was presented in a way that was highly simplified, and was frustrating to them. So those are a couple. And I mentioned before also things like inequitable practices around tracking. When they saw students who were predominantly white and wealthier being able to access the best resources, and students from families with fewer, you know, less social capital, not being able to, you know, access all of the resources that the school held, and also disciplinary, inequitable disciplinary practice issues as well.
It seems like all of those issues are probably being compounded right now by all of the crisis that we're facing. For example, I can imagine that there's teachers who are so frustrated with remote learning because some of their students, not because they're not motivated to learn, but because they don't have access to Wi-Fi or technology, can't access their teacher and can't access learning, which, as you mentioned, isn't a question of their motivation or the teacher's willingness to teach more than it is a testament to the fact that as a society, we've made decisions to not provide these things to kids or to all kids. So I'm wondering what sort of concerns you have about this, the all of the crisis that we're facing right now and how it might contribute to demoralization.
I think that you've made a really important point, Chris. And one of the things that I've noticed, and you know, a lot of what I do these days is, in addition to the formal research that I'm doing, I like to keep an eye on teacher Twitter and sort of take the temperature of what are teachers saying about going back. And, you know, so we are in an impossible situation right now. And so I want to acknowledge that there are the way we've already set things up. And I think you made a great point that we as a society had already made these choices to be okay with this inequity. Right. Or, you know, that this inequity is there prior to this pandemic. And right, because this pandemic is both one in which we're battling, you know, novel coronavirus, but we're also battling white supremacy and horrible economic inequality. And you know, one of the things I've heard teachers talk about is what would it look like to actually meet the needs of their students in this time? And are they being given the opportunity to do that? Or are they pressured to what I've heard some places talk about, you know, catch up and make up on all this lost learning, to think that all of our students are going to be just ready to pick up and, you know, start learning without us attending to a lot of other needs that they have, right? That is a source of demoralization. And I want to note that I've also heard from, you know, some teachers and from some school leaders about some school leaders saying, guess what? We don't expect you to make it through a year's worth of curriculum this year. We expect you to be there for your students, and we hope that you get through. I remember one person told me 1/5 of the year, and I don't know how someone came up with 1/5, but you know, like 1/5 of the curriculum. I think that there is another source of a potential source of demoralization if we see. You know, teachers feel demoralized when they feel complicit in doing wrong by students. And, you know, I've seen some requirements for screen time and students appearing on the screen and doing X, Y, and Z while they're on the screen, you know, in terms of slanting or whatever, you know, it might be eye contact. And, you know, for some students, first of all, let's start with, do they have Wi-Fi? And then we can talk about access to laptops or devices to connect with the internet. And then we can talk about how many people are home, and is it a place where a child feels like, or a student can feel like they can show what's going on in their home? Maybe it's not. There may be a lot of chaos. I know there's a lot of chaos sometimes in my home. And so I think some rigid requirements that makes teachers feel as though they're harming students definitely are demoralizing. I think just the fact that we are teaching online for many places now is demoralizing, even though it might be the right choice right now, because none of us signed up to be online instructors, right? I get most of my energy being in a room with my students and bouncing ideas off them and really being present and embodied with them. And, you know, it's just not the same. And again, this is what I mean by it's an impossible situation. I don't think that there is one right answer, and I don't think we have a right answer. I think we have least worst responses right now. I do think also the issue again of investing in products over people, and the idea of, okay, if we invest in this platform, it's going to solve our problems. When if teachers are looking at what they need as professionals and what their students need as learners and humans, and they feel like the investment is just going in the wrong place. And again, that's a very ethically frustrating situation.
So what can teachers do who feel demoralized? What can they do to remoralize themselves? And how can policymakers and school leaders support teachers? Because as you said, it isn't necessarily a question of the teacher themselves that anything's wrong with them, but it also being a question of the conditions. So how would you say both of those groups can support each other and can support the profession of teaching right now through this?
I think the first piece is to recognize that, to acknowledge, okay, there's something fundamental about what I believe about good teaching and good practice that's being violated or that's under duress right now. And so to recognize that, and then to say, okay, are there any choices that I can make to focus on what enables me to feel like I'm doing good work and still keep my job, right? I recognize that there are requirements of what someone must do, but are there ways to de-emphasize the things that seem to just be getting in the way and to really focus on what seems to matter, and what you're committed to doing as a teacher, whether it's in order to uphold the integrity of your profession or to better meet the needs of your students, because those are the two areas where teachers can tend to feel demoralized. I think, at least in this first sort of analysis that I've done, I think that the next piece of that. So again, I want to go back one moment and say, I really do encourage teachers, especially teachers who are tenured, to embrace their agency and embrace being able to make choices and to do what needs to be done to get through this time. I think that, there's been all kinds of research about that teachers tend to be rule followers and conflict averse as a sort of psychological profile of people who generally go into teaching. And so just thinking about in what ways can I make some choices here? The other piece that I think is essential is to find like-minded colleagues, other people, not who just love teaching, but who bring to teaching the particular commitment you bring regarding what motivates you. You know, if that's to be anti-racist, if that is to help students find joy, if it's to help develop critical thinkers, find your people. And your people may not be at your school. And that's okay. Everything's online right now anyway. So, look for your people. And again, I really always make plugs for Twitter because I think it's, and I can talk about it more in a minute in terms of sort of some downsides if you'd like. But I think in general, it's a place to really find community and to find quality professional development that is offered by your peers. And so find your people. And then, you know, I don't know how much energy many of us have, although we're seeing all kinds of these forms of resistance now, is that then find your people and fight for what you believe in, if you have the energy. Some of us don't right now, and that's okay. Right? Some of us have too much going on. But if you have the capacity, work with the people you're with, you know, who are your people, to fight for what you believe in. In terms of sort of school leaders and policymakers, I think it's really important right now to listen to and respond generously to teachers. I think it's really important to get curious about teacher resistance. And so if teachers are resisting something, find out why. Ask for more information, dig more deeply, because you may learn something that is simply procedural that's problematic, but you all also are going to learn a lot about these teachers' values, and that is an opportunity to find some common ground to talk about the values you bring as a leader or a policymaker, and to think about and to problem solve, and to say, okay, so if we share this value, is there a way for us to move forward together, and to make sure that we are either honoring the profession or honoring students the way they need. They need to be treated at this time.
So my last question is whether you have any recommendations for teachers who might be listening.
You know, I want to acknowledge that none of us are doing our very best work right now. But that doesn't mean that we cannot commit ourselves to supporting students and finding the core of what's most important in our work. And this is what I was thinking about before is, you know, both to recognize the incredible value of social media and to recognize the ways it can be exhausting. This is just absolutely personal, right? Just taking vacations from being online, whether that is you commit to not having any devices in your bedroom, to you don't check anything after 10 p.m. and before 6 a.m. You know, I don't know what it is, but to set some boundaries around that, because it's not going to stop. And we need to recognize the ways in which we may have FOMO, and we need to just acknowledge that things are going to keep moving, but we can still do good work if we sort of focus on what needs to be done. But I do think also it's important to also check in, and especially so, you know, I am a white educator, and I say to my fellow white educators that we need to educate ourselves about white supremacy and our complicitness in it. And that we need to recognize the burdens that our few colleagues of color bear. And we need to ask them to not do the work for us, but for us to be ready to be true co-conspirators. And so that means don't fight alone. And that goes across the board. You know, make your union work for you. Establish solidarity around common concerns with your colleagues, but not only with your colleagues, with your students' families and your community members. You know, this is something that all of us are going through, and I think that there's a lot of space for us to find places to work together around shared goals.
Thank you, Dr. Santoro, for those encouraging words. I'm sure there's a lot of teachers out there who are going to benefit greatly from your analysis. Again, Dr. Santoro's book is entitled Demoralized: Why Teachers Leave the Profession They Love and how they can stay. Next month, we'll be speaking with Dr. Ben Williamson. Dr. Williamson is a Chancellor's Fellow in the Center for Research in Digital Education at the University of Edinburgh in the UK. He's an expert in education policy, technology, and data, and is the editor of the journal Learning, Media, and Technology, and the author of Big Data in Education, The Digital Future of Learning Policy and Practice. As always, thanks for listening. We hope you're staying safe. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweet.